I think you got to always hire good people, yeah. people that are smarter, better than mm-hmm. you, and you have to empower them. You have mm-hmm. to let go of things, leverage work down.
Yeah.
But if you train and trust over mm-hmm. time, they will do things the way you expect, but you have to trust and let go.
Welcome back to Evolving Your Workplace, where we discuss real-time workplace issues with experts to get you the best solutions for your company. I'm your host, Carol Schultz, longtime professional recruiter, coach, and creator of the Chief of Staff Scaffold System. Let's get into it. Today, we're going to get into private equity, the pros and cons, and how to plan for succession. I'm excited to have John Scott with me here, a partner at Anders, a team uniquely composed of CPAs, financial thinkers, and experienced advisors that aim to give the power to dream big. John, thanks for joining me today. I've been looking forward to this conversation. Can you first tell the audience a little bit about what you do?
Sure. So I grew up at Anders as a tax partner, and I've been here since the early 90s. And about 5 years ago, we acquired a firm out of Fort Wayne, Indiana, that was fully distributed. They didn't have any bricks and mortar offices anywhere. They were in about 20 states mm-hmm. at the time with their employees, and they did virtual CFO work. And during my time at Anders, I spent a lot of time working with law firms and attorneys. And they wanted to, part of their reason for merging in with us was to scale into different industries. Mm-hmm. And so I have, for the last 3.5-4 years, headed up the law firm vertical for virtual CFO services for law firms.
Got it. So we talked about a lot of things in a prior call, but I want to talk a little bit about your opinion. I know I have very strong opinions of this, your opinion on taking private equity.
You know, a lot of firms, both law firms and accounting firms, mm-hmm. and it's a little more restricted in the law firm arena by state, but are taking private equity. And I think, you know, it can be a good thing for the current owners. It can be their exit where they get a nice check. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if it's good for the younger owners or the up-and-coming leaders mm-hmm. because private equity expects a certain return right. on its investment. And we've had experience here in St. Louis and in the Midwest with professional service firms that have sold to private equity that if you don't hit the numbers yeah. at a certain period in time, they not only say, hey, no more hiring, but you also have to make layoffs. And mm-hmm. we've actually benefited from that here at Anders because we always have the philosophy of if there are good people available, we're going to hire them. And so when some of these other firms that have forced reductions in staff, mm-hmm. we're happy to take those people because they're really good people. And sometimes you get to pick up some of the clients that those people were working on. You might have to pay for them, but they're good clients too.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought that up. And we'll come back to private equity then since you've already brought this up, which is the, as you said, we picked them up. And we first talked, you made it really clear that even if we don't have a space for that hire, we're going to make that hire anyway.
We have always had the philosophy yeah. that we would hire ahead. And if we found somebody that was really talented, regardless of the impact on profit, we would mm-hmm. do that because we believe that they will grow and fill up mm-hmm. and they will become profitable. And we don't want to make a decision that, hey, we really don't have the work for them right now. They're good people.
Yeah.
So we're going to snatch them up and grow with them.
You know, and I have to tell you, that is such music to my ears because as somebody who spent prior to what I do now, 30 years as a professional headhunter, I can't tell you how many times somebody would say, sorry, Carol, I just don't have the headcount. And I'm thinking, do you realize how good this person is? Like what you're missing here?
Right.
And because I think so much of that is driven, and you're a private firm, but I think so much of that is driven by who your investors are, right? So that kind of brings us back to private equity, but it also brings us back to venture capital.
Right.
Right. And they may be saying, well, you know, you've got this much money to spend. And, you know, if you do this, then you can't spend money on that. And, you know, that takes me back to thinking, well, when you're looking at term sheets, right, you better start thinking about ahead to think about some of these things. Well, what happens when somebody so great comes on the market, but we just don't have headcount? Can we figure out a way to hire that person anyway? knowing that they're going to bring the value. And then, you know, as you said, eventually the profits will come and all the things will come in after that, because they're also, to your point, bringing in, you know, they had clients at that other company.
They have a great reputation. They have great knowledge. And
that's right.
Even if their clients can't follow them, they will build a book of business and, mm-hmm. and we can grow with them. And I think what you're talking about is being independently owned mm-hmm. and privately owned. Mm-hmm. You have the autonomy to make those investment decisions.
That's
well,
right.
When someone else is the owner, mm-hmm. they're dictating what you can do and can't do.
Why is it that so many law firms are selling out to private equity, John?
I think the ones that are doing it, clearly they're in a jurisdiction that allows it. Mm-hmm. But I think, and many professional service firms are in this boat, whether it's a doctor practice, accounting mm-hmm. practice, or a law firm, mm-hmm. where they haven't developed those future leaders. Mm-hmm. And so this is their best exit.
Meaning they don't have to worry about it, or this gives them a better opportunity to develop those future leaders?
No, they didn't spend the time over the last 10 or 15 years developing those leaders.
So they're basically SOL.
Right. So their only option is private equity. And it's not a bad option for a firm like that, but the people that are left there,
right,
it's not great for them.
You know, I've got an acquaintance, and he and his two partners built, I don't know, they're a government contractor. Okay. And they built a very successful firm here somewhere in Colorado. And he, I remember asking him a number of years ago, so tell me a little bit about the benefits that you give your employees. I mean, have you given out any sort of equity? Oh, no, the three of us own the company in full. I said, why would anyone come to work for you?
Right. What's
and
the future?
His response, and I couldn't even fathom that, was that, well, they love the work they do. And I thought, oh, bullshit. That may be the case. Well, you know, we told him we'd take care of him. Famous last words.
Yeah.
Right. He's now out of the company. He's taken his money and he's gone. Right. You know, and I just thought, wow, I wonder if they had any drop off as a consequence of that.
I'm sure they did. And not everyone wants to be an owner or a chief.
Mm-hmm.
But
yes.
The people that you want to lead your firm or your organization when you're gone.
Yeah.
You need those people that want to step up and be owners.
You know, and that's really interesting about not everyone wants to be a chief. I've got a client right now who's built a, you know, 20-person accounting firm. And, you know, he's making plenty of money. He's not so sure he needs to make any more or wants to make any more. And he says, I'm not even so sure I want to be the CEO.
Yeah.
Well, we can talk about what that would look like for you not to be that, right? I mean, there's
any
number, or maybe to free 70% of your time.
Right. And you can help him find somebody to do that, to run the firm, and he can just be the visionary or the founder.
Well, exactly. Or he can just go back to being an accountant, which is what he loves to do.
Yeah.
Right. So there are many options that he has. And I think that there's just so often people don't think that that's an option for them. Right. So, you know, for business leaders listening, what advice do you have for them to plan for succession?
I think you got to always hire good people,
yeah.
people that are smarter, better than mm-hmm. you, and you have to empower them. You have mm-hmm. to let go of things, leverage work down.
Yeah.
But if you train and trust over mm-hmm. time, they will do things the way you expect, but you have to trust and let go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see this in family-owned businesses where the grandfather who started the business, he was a great entrepreneur. He ran the business for years, never fully let go to his son or daughter. And then, of course, to the next generation after that. And a lot of times those businesses fail.
That's right.
And so it's a function of they didn't train and trust the next generation of leaders mm-hmm. to take over.
Mm-hmm.
In an ideal world, you would have a business that you could walk away from, even if it was just to take a 2-month trip to Europe,
mm-hmm.
and it would run fine without you.
Right. You know, it's interesting to that point, because I spoke to somebody, gosh, it was probably mid to late last year, who was interested in being on the podcast. And he was a founder of this company, and he had a super interesting product. And he had brought in a couple of CEOs, both had failed. And I mean, that doesn't surprise me. He doesn't know what he's doing from the standpoint of replacing himself, right? But he finally brought somebody in who bought the company. And I said to him, well, then it makes sense for me to interview that person if that person's now the CEO and the owner of the company. No, I should be the one to be interviewed. And I said, sorry,
Yeah.
And that's exactly your point. This guy is just unwilling to let go.
Thinking, it destroys value though, too.
Right.
When you have an organization that runs without the founder, that's more valuable than something that is dependent upon that founder still being there and still coming in.
Well, especially when he was north of 70, which he was.
Right. And why not enjoy your time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have a friend that retired at 60.
Yeah.
And I have no idea how much money he has or doesn't have. And I said, wow, 60, that's awesome. Mm. I said, why? He goes, I go by the rule of 72. And I thought, is that where in finance where things, you know, at 7% double every 10 years? And he said, no. He goes, I figure at 72, my body's going to start breaking down. So I want to enjoy the next 12 years.
Hopefully more than 12.
Right.
So you've been with Anders for all intents and purposes your entire career.
Right. I had a brief stint at a small firm, but after college, I was here from the early 90s.
Right. Right. So, you know, that dates both of us really, because, you know, that's when I started in my business was in the mid-90s, late 1992. I guess that would be the early 90s. What was it about this company that had you join? And, you know, of course, you've moved up the food chain considerably and stay.
You know, Bob Minkler started the firm with Jim Anders in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And it really was a family firm. Nobody was related, although we do have some nepotism now, but it's approved. But Bob always had the position or the thought that, hey, get your work done and come and go as you please. He had three boys that were active in activities, and he would go and participate in those. So I was able to coach my children. I was able to do things at home. As long as I got my work done, it didn't matter when it happened. And so that's what really attracted me to the firm and helped me stay. And also I saw early on that there was a path for me here.
Yes.
Now, of course, you question yourself along the way and you have bad days and bad months, but Whitey Herzog was the coach of the Cardinals for a long time.
He was.
He had a famous statement.
The baseball Cardinals.
That's right. The baseball Cardinals. Sometimes the moves you don't make are the best moves. And of course, I had opportunities to go somewhere else, but I always thought that this was the place for me.
I want to talk specifically about the virtual CFO services that you do, because, you know, as you know, as we've spoken about, I am a major advocate for fractional executive work. Companies don't always need somebody full-time right away.
Right.
And this is a way for them to get an expert for probably a little bit less money. I mean, it's not going to be cheap, but it's not like hiring somebody full time either.
And, go ahead.
And you know, as like I said, as somebody who does that myself with fractional chief of staff services, right? I just think fractional. I am completely an advocate of fractional services, especially with smaller companies.
Yeah, smaller and mid-sized companies that haven't grown to the point of having full-time people like yourself or us, there is about a 20% discount on the fees. And we not only bring a VCFO, a virtual CFO, but also a staff accountant and a tech person. So we're bringing almost an entire finance team to you for about 80% of the cost with less risk, because when you hire a CFO or a controller, you're taking a risk that you hire the right person.
That's
it might be 12 months before you figure that out.
I love that, because that's what I always tell people is that the unique mechanism, right, at least for me, and it sounds like it's really similar for you, right? It's kind of a try before you buy model. So you're in there doing the work, and guess what? You're figuring out what's working, what's not working, you know, and that's what I get to figure out with alongside the CEO as their partner, is to figure out, what's the, you know, this is about 80% of what I do, but we have to figure out the other 20% that we don't know that we don't know.
Right.
And you don't know that when you just make that hire. And it's interesting that I, in the past, had placed chiefs of staff. I had my own chief of staff. But it never dawned on me. This is something that it'd be really valuable for CEOs, because they just don't know what they don't know. And it's exactly the same thing for you. You know, they hire a CFO, and the next thing you know, oh my goodness, this person's missing 20% of what we need, because we didn't know that's what we needed.
Right. And you find that out over time. And we actually, during the opening part of an engagement, spend about 8 weeks doing onboarding, where we bring additional team members to the to the project, and we go through and we analyze all the finance functions and their current procedures, and we make recommendations. Of course, it's their decision what they want to implement or not, but we make recommendations along the lines of automating things to create some efficiencies and help them going forward.
You know, you also talked a lot of, you talked about remote work and over your career and how, you know, the importance of you get your job done and you can go off and do something, you know, something else. I didn't miss my kids' games, right?
Right.
And, you know, we live in a world now that people are in such a panic over, oh my God, if I'm not at work, you know, a million hours a day, you know, they're going to think I'm not working hard enough. Or, you know, so many of these CEOs of public traded companies, I would say by and large, making everybody come back into the office. And I just don't understand that. Like, what are you thinking culturally when you start thinking like that? I mean, it tells me you don't trust your people. Maybe you maybe haven't made very good hires, so you can't trust them.
And we are quite the opposite of that. Right. So prior to the pandemic, I would say we were just like every other company. You had to have FaceTime. You had to be in the office. We acquired Summit. They were fully distributed.
Right.
They handle culture in a different way. They get together twice a year in retreats to bring everybody together.
Big advocate of that.
So then we hit the pandemic and, you know, everybody was scattered. And we compressed about 5 years worth of remote work learning into 18 months. But the benefit of not needing to be in a brick and mortar office is that if I need specific talent, it doesn't have to be in St. Louis.
Of course.
I need an audit manager with startup experience.
You can go anywhere and look
for
them. It can
be in Oklahoma City. It can be in California, although I'd prefer not California or New York. But it can be in any state. It could be overseas. There's some complications there. But the point is, we have been able to grow so much faster by opening up our mindset to remote work. And so we have 60,000 square feet in our footplate here in downtown St. Louis. We thought we were busting at the seams and we would need more space. We went to a hybrid system, a remote work environment where people can come in,
grab a
or
desk.
They can not come in. And all of a sudden, we don't need more space. We can repurpose the space we have and be just fine, even with our substantial growth.
Yeah, and that's so great. And of course, I have worked remotely since 2002, right? And so it was way before so many, most companies were hit, you know, again, it was living in a blind spot. What is remote work? And I covered remote territories and it worked really well. You know, people used to say, I mean, and this is the days before video, right? So it wasn't like I could actually get on a call with somebody and see them and have that conversation with them. Now, and ever, you know, all the work I did was over the telephone. And you know, but still, it allowed me, I mean, to make really great relationships with people. And I think what people don't often, and as much as I love to be in front of people, it's nice not to have to travel as much.
Yeah.
Right? And I can, if I want to sit and, you know, talk to them, I can do what you and I are doing.
Yeah, and that's the key. The key is communication, right? In the old days, you walk down the hall and you talk to so-and-so about a project. Now, and I struggle with this. I want to do a video call, or I don't want to play tag via email or Slack. I'd rather we talk on the phone or talk on a Teams or Zoom call so that we can get something done. In fact, you know, generationally, I struggle with the folks that just want to fire off an email because I get 350 emails a day, most of which are not meaningful. And so when somebody says, oh, I sent you an email 2 weeks ago, I'm like, well, when I didn't respond, I would hope that you would set up a Teams call with me or give me a call. I always have my cell phone and I'll deal with it right now.
That's right. Yeah, that's really interesting that you say that because it really does make a difference. I recently had two CEOs reach out to me. One heard me on a podcast and another of all places found me on ChatGPT. I was like, what? And about doing business with me. And both of them called me. They didn't send me an email. They didn't send me a text. They picked up the phone and they actually called me.
That's refreshing to me.
Well, I mean, me too. especially somebody who, I mean, call me a dinosaur, call you a dinosaur. This is something that our generation, yours and mine, and theirs, both of these guys, because they're in their same age range as you and I are, you know, we grew up speaking to people on the phone and still realize and understand the importance of communication. Again, I've talked about communication ad nauseum because I firmly believe it is the single lowest common denominator to any company's level of success or failure. If you cannot communicate, and that is the problem. We've people are so attached to their phones that they have to text constantly, you know, or send an email. I'm like, right, to your point. I didn't respond after 2 weeks, you know, and it, you know what happens? And all my millions of emails that I get, the majority of which land in my spam. Hi, just reaching out again. Haven't heard back from you. And I'm thinking to myself, there are a million ways to get my phone number.
Right. Pick up the phone and call me.
Pick up the phone. If you really want to talk to me, pick up the phone and call me.
Right.
And if you can, you know, if you present yourself well, I'm, you know, I'll spend a couple of minutes with you. Dead man would do business with you, but, you know, and that's something I think we've really, really lost.
Well, hopefully we can get back to that.
Yeah, hopefully is right. So, John, what would you say, if anything, are your biggest bottlenecks to growth right now?
I won't say it's a bottleneck, but getting folks to value the finance function and the importance of having good current data. Because some people just think that, you know, it's not that important. But in reality, even if you're doing well, if your financial statements are in great shape and you can forecast the future, mm-hmm. and not only forecast, but then pay attention to that forecast to see if you're deviating off that trend line and then course correct to ensure that you get to your destination and hit your goals, mm-hmm. you're going to be more valuable. So if you do have an exit, you do want to sell your business, people are going to pay a premium for that business that has great books and records, great procedures, and a good outlook on the future. Whereas if you're 6 months behind in your financial statements and they're not right, people are going to pay a discount for that firm. Mm-hmm. So it's in your best interest, even currently and in the future, to have great financial records and make data-based decisions on your investments going forward.
So how do you overcome that?
You know, I don't know that I can't overcome it. I just want to prophesy about this and tell as many people about what we do.
Yeah.
And the people that get it.
Yeah.
And the people that don't get it, maybe they get it in the future.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't care if you buy today.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's not now, but not never either. So
yeah.
6 months from now.
Mm-hmm.
And many of our clients have said no initially, not ready for this. But 6 months or a year later, they go, okay, we tried something else. It didn't work out. Let's come back and try this. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it usually works out well. In fact, I almost like those clients better because they've seen the alternative.
They've seen the light.
Right.
Yeah. That's
they didn't like it.
Yeah, that's really great. How is your team at Andrews structured?
We have a pods. And mm-hmm. in the legal niche, my folks work on other things as well. But I want to build a concentration of people that really know law firms well.
Mm-hmm.
And so right now I have two VCFOs and then a team of staff accountants below that,
mm-hmm.
as well as some tech people.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, we'll add another VCFO mm-hmm. and additional people underneath so that everyone who works on a law firm is very familiar with, you know, the balance sheet in a law firm is very simple, but there are some unique things, especially when it comes to IOLTA accounting,
mm-hmm.
that are necessary to understand.
And do you have a sweet spot of, you know, size of law firm, whether it be employees or revenues?
It's usually 3 to 50 billers. I mean, when you get beyond 50 billers in a firm, you have a substantial finance department.
Mm-hmm.
And even in those cases, working with a firm right now that has more than that, but they have a great finance department. We're just there to do the advisory piece. There are three legs of the stool to what we do. It's transactional, where we do the bookkeeping and the accounts payable, mm-hmm. accounts receivable.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the advisory piece and the tax piece. If you have taxes and transactions covered, we'll just come in and help you interpret the data and offer best practices, maybe some oversight on your finance department, just to pull everything together. And so our pricing is independent.
Mm.
It's kind of you pick what you want to keep and what we want to do, and that influences the price. And if it's very flexible too. So if 2 months down the road, you say, hey, we'd like you guys to take on payroll administration because the person in-house left, we just change the statement of work and issue a new fee structure and go forward.
Mm-hmm. John, I want to get back to early in our conversation, talk a little bit about PE firms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm pretty much of the mindset that the vast majority are just evil. You know, I mean, I'm sure we could both come up with many things that, you know, they've invested in and immediately bankrupt the company they've just acquired, right? And then sell it for scraps or parts. Or, you know, the fact that private equity firms are now buying up zillions of single family homes and renting them.
Yeah.
Kind of the, you know, the attitude I think I had heard recently, you know, you'll rent for the rest of your life and love it. You don't get to own anything. You know, goodbye, American dream. Right.
Yeah.
And like I said, I don't want to, there are some good private equity firms out there, but I think the vast majority are just terrible and evil. So, you know, how I had a client say to me once, you know, I'm thinking about taking private equity. And I said, why? You know, here's what you get.
Because they don't have an internal transition plan. And I have clients, you know, doctor groups and tree service groups, HVAC groups,
yeah,
who, especially in the HVAC and tree service, their kids didn't want to be a part of the business.
Right.
And they don't have any employees that want to be a part of the business. So mm-hmm. private equity comes along and says, hey,
yeah,
here's a big check and you can roll over equity. As we get bigger, we're going to sell again and get a second bite at the apple.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a bad plan for
right.
them. But the trade-off when you took the big check was you're giving up the autonomy.
Yeah.
All the decisions you used to make, all the perks you used to pull out of the company, now have someone else looking over your shoulder. And sometimes that check is big enough to overcome that.
Right. But is any of that negotiable?
It can be. It's just a function of how much of a check do you want and how much rollover equity do you want.
Right.
Now, that second bite of the apple doesn't always happen mm-hmm. when they thought it might. One of my doctor groups has been expecting a second bite of the apple for 3 or 4 years now. And, you know, market conditions weren't right. The mm-hmm. bigger private equity out there is not ready to buy what they have. I think it will happen, but will it happen at the rate
right.
at which they expect?
Well, and again, you know, we go back to the employees.
Right. What's
you know,
it
they,
mean
they
for
have
them?
Nothing.
Right.
And I have to think that, at least if I were in that position, why would I be loyal to them? I mean, there's
It does make you less loyal because you're going to look around.
You know, I have said for years, and I'll never forget this. It's got to be 25, 30 years ago, probably by now. I can't remember when it was. It was whenever IBM acquired Informix.
Mm-hmm.
Buddy of mine was a first line sales manager at Informix. And he was at I will not forget, he was at 130% of his annual number when the acquisition happened. And then what does IBM do? What is IBM famous for? Readjusting his quota.
Mid-year.
Mid-year, because IBM was and probably is still famous for managing your income. Right. And that's how they manage your income, by changing your quota. So he was at 130% of his annual number. IBM acquires Informix, and now he's at 80% of his annual number. And he said to me, God, Carol, I've been so loyal to them. And it was like an epiphany. And I responded, you know, companies are only loyal to you insofar as it suits their needs and interests.
Right.
Consequently, you should only be loyal to them insofar as it suits your needs and interests. Now, here's the caveat. That doesn't mean every time a headhunter calls you, you should be out interviewing, right? I mean, if somebody's really presenting you with something that's a better opportunity and it looks real, then investigate it.
Yeah.
Right? But it doesn't mean you should be, you know, looking at everything that, you know, pops its head like whack-a-mole, right? But you still have to really realize that. Which company was it that swore? Was it wasn't SurveyMonkey? Was it one of the big companies that the founder said he would never sell, and he sold. And the employees were like, WTF?
What just happened? Yeah.
Yeah. You swore you'd never do this.
You have to stay away from those declarative statements that you will never do.
Right. Now, yeah. Always and never. Right. Yeah. So, you know, I think that that's, you know, that's really the moral of the story. You know, it's one thing if this firm has been giving you some sort of equity or profit sharing or something, right? A CEO buddy of mine has just built, came in as there'd been other CEOs prior to him. They'd burned through tens of millions of dollars. And he grew the company in just over 2 years from about 6 million to 40 million. Company just sold for more than it's worth. And I said to him, well, what's your contract look like? You're gonna get whatever the percentage is. He says, oh no. I said, what do you mean, oh no? It's in your contract. I wouldn't let them off the hook for that. Well, they're gonna say this, they're gonna say it. I said, I don't care what they're gonna say.
I'm glad you brought that up because when we changed our deferred comp or buyout for partners, we went to a value share model. And there are three classes of stock. There's an A share, which everybody that has an equity interest has one share. That's your vote. There are B shares, which cover your buyout. And there are C shares, which are synthetic, but get allocated to the staff. And so the staff has a way to either be awarded shares as they grow in their career, or they can actually purchase shares. And what it does, or what we're hoping it does, is create some stickiness, some loyalty, because they do have a synthetic piece of the firm. I doubt there would be a liquidation event, but the hope is over time, as they grow in their career and as they get close to making partner, they would trade those C shares in for B shares.
Right.
That's part of their buy-in. And then over time as partner, they would get more B shares and that would be their buyout.
Right.
But even the lowest staff member is going to get allocated some of those synthetic C shares. Mm-hmm. And let's say, you know, because the younger folks don't necessarily stay in their career as long as we have. Let's say that, you know, they've accumulated $30,000 worth of shares 5 years from now and they want to go somewhere and they're vested. There is a vesting period for those shares.
Of course.
They could cash those in and walk away with a nice chunk of money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm curious, what is your vesting period? I mean, I know what it traditionally is in tech, but...
You know, I think if you buy the shares, you're fully vested. But if you're awarded shares, I think it's a 4-year vesting.
Yeah, which is typical. I mean, by and large in tech, it's a 4-year vest with a 1-year cliff, meaning you don't earn anything till your first 12 months. And then it vests, you know, 1/36th from then for the next 3 years. That's fairly common, right? I mean, there's certainly things outside of that.
I mean, we're doing it to retain them, right?
Of course.
And the longer they stay, the longer they will stay.
Mm-hmm. And is this something you recommend to your clients that they do for their companies?
Well, it's tricky in a law firm. We do recommend it to other clients. I think in a law firm where you wouldn't typically see it there, I think what you need to say in a law firm is, hey, here's a path to equity.
Yeah.
Here's a path to ownership. And be clear about what has to happen to get that ownership. And what does it mean to be a partner?
Mm-hmm. Awesome. John, is there anything I haven't asked you that we haven't talked about that you want to talk about to leave us with?
No, I've thoroughly enjoyed this. I do want to tout my book, Judicial Dollars and Cents. If we could put that in the show notes, that'd be great. We also have we didn't develop the maturity model, but we developed a maturity model assessment that we use for clients and prospects. And what it does, it's about a 10-minute series of questions that analyzes and self-grades your business's finance function.
Okay.
And it's not meant to get super critical about what you're doing, but it's meant to identify how mature you are in those areas.
Yeah.
And then what we recommend is you take the next 6 to 12 months working on one or two of the areas to get incrementally better.
Got it. And we can add that to the show notes as well.
Perfect.
So no worries. All right. Well, gosh, John Scott, partner at Anders, thank you so much for being with me. I had been looking forward to this conversation, and I hope that my audience gets a lot out of it.
Thank you, Carol. This was fun.
Thanks for listening to Evolving Your Workplace. Is there a topic you want to discuss? Let us know what you think in a review. And don't forget to click follow to stay up to date on upcoming episodes. Thanks again for listening, and see you next time.